Hello, this is Nicholas Briggs, and you're listening to the Sirens of Audio.
Message from Cyber Control. You must subscribe to the Sirens of Audio on YouTube today, or you will be deleted.
G'day audiophiles, you are listening to the Sirens of Audio, the Doctor Who podcast that explores Doctor Who in the audio medium. My name is Dwayne.
And my name is Philip. G'day Dwayne, g'day audiophiles.
And we are privileged today to be joined by the legendary podcast and sound design extraordinaire, Benji Clifford.
Absolute pleasure to be here, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on it.
Yeah, welcome Benji, great to have you here.
Now, absolute pleasure. Benji, there's been a bit of sad news this week that I've discovered only the last couple of days. The Benji and Nick show is coming to an end in a few weeks. What's happening?
Yes, it's a real shame. We've been doing the Benji and Nick show, which is a vintage TV podcast where we talk about TV from the past. We've been doing that for quite a few years now. And we've just found recently, really in the past kind of 6 months to a year, that our workload has just increased so much. We're doing loads of exciting work, not just Big Finish work. We're working for other companies like Anderson Entertainment and stuff like that. And so we've just found that our time and as you know, that our need for utilizing that time has gone up. And so we had to sort of make a sacrifice. And unfortunately, the Benji and Nick show seemed like the only thing really we could do to give ourselves some more time, which is a shame. I'm really sad to stop doing it. We've built up such a lovely community of people and vintage TV fans and so it would be sad to say goodbye to that, but we'll still be doing the Big Finish podcast, so there'll still be a bit of podcast madness every week.
That's good. But the audience just never came back after Nick ripped into the tripods, did they?
Well, it's funny you should say that, actually, because I got a phone call from my friend Robin, Robin Hayter, who was in the Tripods Series 2, and he played Fritz. And he phoned me up and he said, "What's all this I heard about you slagging off the tripods?" And I said, "Well, hold on." I said, "You listen to it. I'm defending the tripods. It's Nick that's going against it." But yeah, I think the audience was very split on that one. I think 50% absolutely agreed with everything that Nick said, and the other 50, like myself, will fight to the death to defend the tripods.
Absolutely. All right, I want to talk to you about your sound design, but before we do that, do you know what I see up ahead, Philip? Do you know what I see?
Oh, no.
It's a rabbit hole. Here we go. All right. So go with me on this, fellas. Go with me. I was watching the other day Abbott and Costello with my kids. So I bet you don't know where this is going to go. I am going to tie it into audio stuff eventually. But what I found I was thinking was that with the slapstick humour, I was hearing little gasps of intake of breath with my kids with the violence that was going on screen. And I suddenly realised that my kids don't see that kind of violence, even in a comedic sense, portrayed on TV these days. And it got me thinking about Doctor Who as well, particularly episodes like The Mind of Evil. You've got people getting shot on screen, dropping dead. Remember The Seeds of Doom with Tom Baker snapping that guy's neck, and, well, not snapping his neck, but sort of twisting his neck, and you heard the creak noise. And there seems to be a heck of a lot of violence in the olden days that we don't get today. Have you noticed? What is it? Are we Are we not as resilient, teaching our kids resilience anymore, or is it a good thing that we've left those things behind? What do you think about that, Benji?
I think there's pros and cons to this sort of thing, really. I mean, first and foremost, it's do you want your kids to be exposed to violence? Ideally, I don't think I'd want my kids to be watching violent things. I mean, I've not got kids, so, to be watching violent things if I don't know about it. But equally, it's important to see things and be exposed to these things. I mean, for me growing up, I never thought about things in such a deep way. I sometimes think that they think too much of kids. It's like, when I was a kid, I remember one of my earliest memories, actually, was coming downstairs. It was past my bedtime. I couldn't sleep for whatever reason. I came downstairs and my parents were watching The Spy Who Loved Me. And it was the end of that film with, the bit where they're, all the people are storming through the underground, the water base with the submarines. There's explosions and guns and, punch ups and all this sort of stuff. And I didn't sit there and think, they're firing guns. This is awful. Or this is really scary. I was just captivated by what I was seeing. And in a non kind of, I don't know, it never distressed me in that way. So, but I do think there's definitely a lack of it. Television and film is mostly television is a lot sort of more protected, I think, for kids. So who knows?
Yeah, particularly the gun violence. You just don't see in the revived series of Doctor Who, you don't see those on-screen deaths like even that we did in the old series. It's like, I think Mary Whitehouse would be very happy that we've come so far. What are your thoughts on that, Philip?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, interesting to talk about Abbott and Costello and their slapstick violence, which is, it's huge. Actually, my earliest memories of Abbott and Costello was actually in London at my grandfather's house. He had Abbott and Costello films on the old projectors, and he used to pull out a projector, which I now own. And actually, I've got one of the films still, and pull out the old Abbott and Costello movies, and he actually put them through the projector and set them all up, and we used to watch them on a wall. And so that was my first experience with Abbott and Costello, totally silent because it was just a silent projector, so it was just the images. But I just remember it being so funny and so hilarious in that. So I think there is still violence in some areas. So if you go to the Marvel Universe, that is all violence. It's all punching, hitting, and carrying on. And then a lot of computer games that my kids are playing are very violent as well. I can't stand them. But you're right, Doctor Who, basically as the show came back, stepped back. And so you can shoot people with guns, you can, Dalek rays and things are all okay. I think some of the Cybermen shock when the Cybermen first returned was the fact they touched and electrocuted. So I actually think it was actually that physical touch which actually made that death very compelling. But by the time they came back at the end of season two, they had their guns, which actually in some ways made the death less real. I do remember talking about the fact that the trouble with war now being more technological is you don't get to look in the person's eyes of the person you're killing. Because when you look in their eyes, it's hard to go through with it. So I think as we've moved further away from that actual seeing the violence hurt, the easiest to become more violent. But yeah, I think it depends on the world you move in. I do think Doctor Who has moved away from the physical violent stuff, the fisticuffies that Tom Baker used to occasionally get up to. But they can find another place, and other universes still have it quite a bit, I think.
I think Doctor Who as well is made to be an export as well. And so in order to export something like that to other countries, you've got to make sure that it's not too controversial, because even back then, bits of Doctor Who, thank goodness they were cut now because they're some of the only existing clips we've got.
We cut it to bits straight when it arrived in Australia. we cut it up to like to buggery. Well,
kept all the best bits. But it's so I can see the logic behind making it slightly less violent and terrifying, because then you can sell it onto other countries and they can watch it and they don't have to worry. It's good family entertainment. You can put it on whenever you like in the day.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the cuts, Philip. When I eventually saw the uncut version of The Case of Androzani, I couldn't recognise it. It was totally different. There was so much cut from that. It was incredible.
That last episode used to just jump, didn't it? Like, what has just happened? Like,
yeah, because they cut the whole unmasking and everything. So you sort of got a flash. Yeah.
There's about three characters who died you don't even see on screen die. And so you got to the end and think, what happened to all these people? Because they were just gone, and that was quite late. I mean, William Hartnell and Patrick Travers got cut to pieces. That was, but you know, Peter Davison much later on. It was astounding what they used to cut out.
So Benji, how does that translate to audio? What are we allowed to hear as far as violence goes on audio? Do the BBC have rules on what we can hear or how much we can hear portrayed, or is it because we don't see it? Is it no holds barred?
I mean, everything that we produce has to go through the BBC, you know, ultimately to get clearance. And it's very, I mean, we've got such a, you know, we've been working with the BBC for such a long time now that, you know, we know what they expect and what they don't expect. I have actually worked on releases where we've had to cut things back because it's been too frightening or it's been too graphic. And sometimes it's a simple thing as well. Sometimes, this is a really interesting thing from a sound effects perspective. You can actually, we've had productions before where, for example, the villains are using guns as in the guns that we have, that, you know, firing ammunition and bullets. And it's amazing how we've had moments where we say, well, let's swap those guns out for laser sounds instead, you know, science fiction weapons. And you can dramatically change a production from being graphically violent to sort of fantastically violent in a different way. And so it's more accepting for people. And we have done that on a multitude of different occasions, actually. And it's just helped something to be a little bit less frightening for people. But yeah, you know, it's about being mindful, really, definitely. But there's, yeah, we have cut plenty of stuff, you know, in my time working there, definitely.
It was just making me think of one of the most scary scenes in the whole Big Finish catalogue. Was not from Doctor Who, obviously, because you've got scarier stuff out there. But Nick Briggs doing, he did some kind of monologue in Frankenstein when he was doing I don't know if you remember what I'm referring to exactly, but there was a scene there towards the end where he was just talking about what he was doing to his victims, and it was just absolutely horrific. And he was just doing it with words and the tone of voice. It was just incredible. And that was very scary. Very, very scary. So
it's what you want from Frankenstein, though, isn't it? A little bit of
spine-chilling
action.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good. No, interesting conversation, guys. Let's get out of the rabbit hole, and we'll let's talk to you, Benji, about some of your audio work. But first, have you always been a Doctor Who fan?
Always, yeah. Doctor Who is responsible for so many things, including a career. Before, you know, working for Big Finish was the end result of years of just being a Doctor Who fan and making Doctor Who things on my own for fun. So, yeah, I've always loved Doctor Who. My first memory of Doctor Who was when I was young and I went into... This will age me. So I went into Blockbusters, which don't exist anymore. Video rentals, bring them back, I say. I went into there and there was a collection of VHS tapes. You know, the old Doctor. There's only about four. I think Death of the Daleks, Genesis of the Daleks on some time experiment. Revenge of the Cybermen wasn't there, actually.
Oh,
it wasn't
okay.
There. I know. I was surprised. I know, you know, years later. There was the double one. There was also the Spiders, Planet of the Spiders. And I think that might be it. Maybe the Peter Cushing films.
Time Warrior?
So that, no. I wish Time Warrior was there. Okay. That's one of my favourite stories. And I watched them. I saw them. I think my mum at the time, she said, oh, I remember that. It's Doctor Who. I watched that when I was younger. So we got it out and I just fell in love with it. And those things, I mean, they might as well have belonged to me because I just kept re-renting them. I just wanted to watch them again and again and started a lifelong
love
affair.
So how old were you then?
Oh, gosh, I would have been probably about, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7, I would say. So, because Doctor Who wasn't on when I was younger. I grew up in the wilderness years. So a lot of my doctors are fan film doctors and fan audio doctors. You know, people like Chris Hoyle and, you know, Matthew Chambers and people like that, who are, you know, lovely people. They were making fan films and fan audios. That was my Doctor Who, was watching these people on the very early, listening to these people on the early internet.
Would it be allowed now?
Well, it's a different world now. It was a really, you know, back then, you type Doctor Who into Google and you just get a couple of pages. You know, I remember there was S. Hill Pages, which is Stephen Hill, who I ended up meeting at a convention, and I think he was slightly baffled when I said, are you the guy that runs the website with the Doctor Who pictures on? He said, well, I did about a million years ago, yes. And I said, I remember that website. So, yeah, you know, I've always loved it for as long as I can really remember.
How did you get into audio design?
It was an interesting thing. So, obviously, Big Finish has been around for a lot of my life. I'm 29 at the moment, so Big Finish has been around for a lot of that, and so I've been listening to Big Finish from quite a young age, and as well as that, like I said, you know, a lot of the fan audios as well. And so I started just playing around, you know, inviting friends over, getting behind microphones, cameras. I started then, it moved on to another stage where on like message boards online, you'd say, oh, looking for any actors or anybody that wants to get involved. And you get other Doctor Who fans writing in with their computer microphones. You know, we record just on our own. And then I piece them together and do some post-production work on, which is kind of weird because that's essentially what I've been doing for the past 2 years with coronavirus, is doing it the old fashioned way. So it's not really been much of a shock because it just feels very how I started, you know. And so I started doing that, and that was kind of my interest in production came through from working on, you know, these fan audios and that. I ended up sending one in. Somebody told me to just go for it and see, you know, and I didn't think anything of it. I was working at a hospital at the time, a mother and baby hospital, and I just sent one off to Big Finish and said, you know, if you've got any work experience or anything, I'd love to just be able to, you know, do something with you guys. Got a reply back from Ian, who said, I'm not, you know, I don't think we've got any work experience stuff. I'm really sorry, you know. And I thought, okay, well, whatever. I said, thank you so much. And then I got an email back about a minute later, said, actually, can I just send this on to Nick? So I thought, yeah, be my guest. Nick heard it, and you know, I had to do a small audition piece, and then ever since then, back to back, I've been working for Big Finish. It's just been years of great fun. So it all goes back to that same sort of couple of friends huddling around a microphone, being Doctor Who.
So if you meet someone in the pub and they ask you what you do, how do you describe what you do?
It's a good question. That's a very good question. I tend to tell people, I'd usually say I make sound effects and write music. And then that usually is a good way to lead into conversation. Because if I say, you know, I make audio drama, people kind of they think, what, podcasts? Or, you know, so by saying I do that, that opens up questions. Say, oh, what type of sound effects do you do? And I say, well, I do a lot of things like Doctor Who and stuff like that. And it leads on to conversation. But yeah, I mean, it's a wacky job. It's definitely not the job I expected to be doing. And I, as you can hear, I make all my own sound effects. I've got people downstairs building a bathroom. I expected to be in a studio, but the guy building it broke his hand, or certainly hurt his hand. So I'm at home and I've got a bathroom being built underneath me. So I'm so sorry to everybody watching and listening for the noises.
We'll need an update later, the pictures of the bathroom.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, I'll make sure they're there.
So do you remember your first job with Big Finish?
Yes, it was Countermeasures Series 4. And I was really excited because I love Remembrance of the Daleks anyway, with those characters. And so and I love the past, as you know, vintage TV podcast. I love anything set in the past. So it's a marriage, you know, made in heaven, really, for me to work with these great characters in the 1960s setting. I was absolutely terrified beyond belief to do the job because, you know, you go from being in kind of, you know, anything goes, you're your own boss with this one, you know, you're writing, you're directing your own stuff, you're just playing around, it doesn't really matter, to suddenly people are going to buy these things, and I've got a director and a producer, and they've got actors in it who are well-known actors who are very good, you know. And so, yeah, I was terrified, but I had so much fun with that one. And I think, you know, every audio you do, you kind of learn a little bit more. And so I'm too scared to listen back to it now in case I'm not happy with it. But I certainly, at the time,
it's very good.
Oh, thank you.
Don't worry.
Yeah, it really is wonderful.
Thank you so much. And of course, you know, I was absolutely awestruck as well because Nick was doing the music, and I didn't know Nick at all then. I'd never met him. I only knew the legends that was, you know, Nick Briggs, Big Finish, Daleks. So I was scared and I wanted to make sure it was right. And I thought he'll be listening to it. You know, you can't get more up against it when you've got that kind of guy in charge listening to it all. So it was, yeah, I loved it. It was a great series. I'm so glad we're still doing bits and bobs of countermeasures here and there.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions. Countermeasures, Series 4 box set.
There was a moment back there at New Horizons. It was as if I remembered something. Something terrible.
Actions have consequences. If anyone should know that, it's you.
Do.
Just keep driving.
Look out! The gun!
Allison! Rachel, stay back!
How many people have died because of your blundering?
Ian, no! It's a dead man's switch!
What? Police is gonna blow everybody!
Countermeasures is to cease any and all investigations into New Horizons. In short, back off, or else.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Boom!
Come on, Professor.
That's a few more sleeping beauties out for the count.
I'm going to get us out.
They're a threat to the nation, Sergeant, and I order you to shoot them.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Where do you get involved? Do you go to? Were you at studio, or do you just get delivered, here's all the recordings, go for it? At what point do you get involved?
So, sometimes we go up to the studio just to hang out, really, or to offer some tips. If something's very specific, they might want a sound designer there just to be able to say, maybe we need a bit of this recorded. But a lot of the time it gets recorded and we've got a multitude of different recording studios, and then it gets sent to me and I'm kind of just left to my own devices. I might get a sort of briefing from a director about what they want. But a lot of the time I'm left to my own devices, and it's really up to the sound designer's judgment to kind of deliver it to a director and hopefully be, you know, something that you think the director will like and is right for the script. So it's a bit of judgment there. But yeah, it's scary how much freedom we get at the start, actually, to just, you know, here are the sounds, here are the actors, go for it.
So you're just told to come up with these sounds and you virtually from scratch.
Yeah, so a lot of it is, it's just, you know, we read the scripts and it's down to the art of the sound designer, really, is to interpret how you're going to do something and how it should sound. Because there are so many ways you can do a sound effect. You can, you know, it's like it's like throwing a punch is a really great example, because you can do the over-the-top Hollywood punch, which is like a sort of a whoosh and a slap and a pow, you know, and it sounds like you've been punched in the face by Superman or Batman. You can do a realistic one, which is hardly any sound at all, you know, just a sort of little knock. Or you could go the other way and have a really gory, you know, punch. I've just taken out two teeth and broken a nose. But it's all about the judgment for what you're doing. And you think, you know, where do I take this? How do we want to do it? You know, there's a huge difference between sound design for Doctor Who and sound design for like Survivors. You know, one is absolutely measurable end of the world stuff and the other is fun science fiction. So it's all about the judgment, really, and how you approach it.
Do different directors have more or less to say to you about what they want? We spoke with Ken Bentley earlier in the year, and he seems to be very much trusting people and just handing everything over and say, I'll do this part, you just do with that, and he seems to be more hands-off. Other directors seem to be a bit more directive. Have you found some directors are the one much more directive in terms of what they want you to do or not?
Every director's different, because every director's studied in different ways and comes from different backgrounds and has, you know, as we all do with Doctor Who, everybody's kind of got their own idea of what Doctor Who is and what it should be. And so working with directors, I mean, I've worked with quite a few different directors now, and I've never had a time at Big Finish where I've thought, you know, I can't get on with this person. A lot of it is about, you know, I mean, I would say the director I've worked the most with is Ken, actually. And Ken was my first director. And so I've very quickly adapted to the way that he likes working. But, you know, it's different. I've had phone calls before with different directors who've said, this is how I'd like to do things. And others just say, you know, get on with it. I'll just hear it in the end. I think the other thing is people are so busy. So a lot of the time it is a case of, you know, it's not like one director directing one thing. It's that the directors and producers are just making so much that there is an element of trust there to just say, you know, go for it, see what happens. So it's honestly, it's a really personal thing. It's just down to the different directors, but they're always fab and they're always lovely.
What's been your most challenging release?
Oh, most challenging release. It's really difficult. I often get asked that and people say, you know, it's a really difficult one. I'd say a lot of the time, I mean, I can tell you the sort of genres that I find harder to do, if that makes sense. So like I find that the science fiction stuff is actually harder to do than the realistic stuff, which is really weird because you ask any other sound designer and they will say the absolute opposite. I find a lot of the kind of science fiction stuff difficult because it's very specific. It has to sound a certain way to reflect what you're talking about. And so, you know, it's for real life things. We kind of know what that sounds like. You know what a door sounds like. You just have to make it sound like the most doory door of all the doors. But in science fiction stuff, it's a lot more difficult. I mean, examples of things in, I've had, I think, 8-legged camels, which is surprisingly hard to get right in terms of how they walk around. That's a real challenge. And I've had other things which are surprisingly easy, like the doctor eating his way through a gingerbread house. That was the easiest sound effects job of my life. Just got to sit and eat gingerbread all day. It's marvelous. So, but it's really hard for me to think on the spot kind of what are difficult things, because I've just done so many things. And what's a challenge at the time, you sort of forget, because at the end it's all done. It's a really weird sort of thing.
You did Stranded, didn't you?
I certainly did, yeah.
So, Philip, was Stranded the set that I remember you saying once that you were distracted by someone making a cup of tea? It was that good?
Yeah, I think it's box set one. I think there's the second episode. There's a cup. The doctor says someone's making a cup of tea, and I was the whole focus was this rotten cup of tea being made, because it's every bit of the sound happening there, and I remember. Just a little tea and the kettle boiling and the teaspoon around the cup, and it was just, I had to go back and listen to the scene again because I missed the dialogue.
Sorry.
It was too good.
I mean, with that, that's a, you know, with Stranded, actually, that was a sort of brief within itself is to kind of, because we're taking Doctor Who from its science fiction roots of spaceships and, you know, extravagant historical places, and then taking it down to a house in Baker Street where the doctor's living a normal life. Things like making a cup of tea are actually really important in kind of grounding people to where you're at, because we all know how long a cup of tea takes to make. And actually Ken Bentley was a really, you know, great factor when we worked on Survivors. His brief on that was, you know, when the character's here, there's no electricity. When they're making a cup of coffee or whatever, they've got to boil the water. We've got to have all this going on. It can't be instant. It can't be fast. It's real life. And I've kind of carried that over to Stranded, actually, to do that. Interesting, just boring fact here when it comes to making a tea. Did you know that cold water and hot water sound completely different? And it's important to use hot water, actually, when you're doing hot water things. There we go.
Okay.
Really?
They really do. Honestly, next time you've got, next time you're in the kitchen, right?
Yep.
Boil the kettle, pour some cold water into a cup and pour it into a cup, and then in another cup, pour the hot water in, and you will notice a different sound. I guarantee it.
I wonder if it's got to do with the steam or the reaction of the cold porcelain on hot water. I don't know.
Well, the atoms would be further apart with the hot water, but I don't know.
Let's break this right down, boys.
Science talk.
Back to science.
It's a weird thing.
From Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Eighth Doctor Adventures, Stranded, Volume 1.
She used every ounce of her strength to escape the Crucible. No control, no navigation. Instinct brought her to her second home, Earth. Then she gave up the ghost.
You're saying you own a house?
Oh, this place.
Isn't this Baker Street? Expensive area.
Number 107. I made the investment a long time ago.
Hello? Can I help you?
Yes. What are you doing in my house?
The past few days, everyone's becoming more paranoid that there could be someone or something else in the house.
The idea of spending the rest of my life here.
There are worse places to live than planet Earth.
The TARDIS isn't responding at all.
Well, we knew it'd be difficult.
I really think I might not get her back.
Doctor, Liv's been shot!
I thought it was safe here, but we've lived our lives so dangerously for so long that we've forgotten death lurks everywhere. Driving a car, walking the street, working in a shop.
A police box on Camden Road. I'm old enough to remember what this was really used for.
Big Finish. We love stories.
But if we're going to be stuck here a while, we might as well give the walls a lick of paint.
I'm a Time Lord. I don't do up kitchens.
One of your recent releases, so you were probably working on this last year, was the Unzahl incursion. So you did half of the box set, the last Third Doctor box set. Were you working on that this year, or was that a last year job?
That was this year, yeah, only a few months ago, yeah.
Okay.
That was great fun. It's my favourite time in Doctor Who is Pertwee era stuff. So
why?
Doing that
why is that your favourite time?
I don't know. I think partly just growing up and watching it, I think obviously when you're exposed to your first kind of Doctor Who stuff, you have a soft spot for it. But I love the 70s as a time, and I like that grounded nature of it. And, you know, I think there's something.
You're just
showing
you weren't born for it, that's all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is that a good thing? Maybe it is. I don't know. You know, so a lot of people say, oh, you can like it from a nostalgic perspective, but when you live through it, it's different. And it probably
so
is.
So tacky.
Everybody says it's tacky, it was horrible, everything was, you know, rubbish. But I like this time of Doctor Who. I love John Pertwee as the Third Doctor. I love his mixture of wisdom, comedy, and, you know, and action, actually, in there. There's that wonderful level of he can do it all, and I really love that. And also, you know, the companions. We had so many, you know, great companions in that time. Liz Shaw, you know, Joe Grant and Sarah Jane Smith. It's like, oh, it's just a pocket in time that I love. And so being able to work on that time in Doctor Who was something that I'd wanted to do for such a long time. And I was just so happy to be able to do it.
So here in Australia, I still remember the year, 1984. The Third Doctor was being shown from the very beginning. I had my cassette recorder pressed up against the TV, recording a couple of episodes of Doctor Who and the Silurians. So because of the regular repeats, we had Doctor repeating every day through the 80s to the late 80s. I always see the Third Doctor as my Doctor, even though I was born the year that Katie Manning left. Because it was showing, I still feel like the Third Doctor was my Doctor, strangely enough, because he was on the TV in the 80s. Here in Australia.
It's that exposure, isn't it? The exposure that you're used to, and it becomes something that's very... Doctor Who's such a personal thing. You know, this is what I say. Everybody's idea and everybody's memories are so different. You know, I have people who swear blind that, you know, 80s Doctor Who is the only Doctor Who, and that anything before it is just not the same show. And, you know, for some people, Doctor Who stopped when William Hartnell left. It's a very weird thing. No show's quite like that, I don't think.
Yeah. What I loved about the Unzahl incursion was your attention to detail in getting it to sound exactly like it was from that era, right down to the opening sting of Ambassadors of Death style sting of the theme. And I really love that. And I guess with you and Nick working on that together, there would have been lots and lots of attention to detail, yeah?
I mean, if you know, this is the type of stuff that we're talking about even when we're not working on it. You know, we love Doctor Who and we love this particular time as well. And we're also, you know, we're into the detail. We love that detail. It's the little bits of stuff that really does it for us. And it's important, you know, for me, it's a responsibility as a creator and as a fan of Doctor Who to get it right. Because the people that listen to Doctor Who are people that love Doctor Who and people that have rewatched those VHS tapes and DVDs a million times over, you know. And so if something doesn't sound right, our fans are going to know, and they, you know, they'll still appreciate a good story, but it'll take them out of what's going on. And so the process for that was, you know, it was delving in. I've digitized all my DVDs for this purpose of going in and nipping sound effects when I need them. And part of that was, you know, going through Doctor's lab sound effects and making a complete clear background. So we've got that noise in there. It's just all little bits like that, which just help, because subliminally when you listen to it, you just know where you are, because you know where those places are. It's just, for me, I just like the details, you know. It's like, I remember I did a story once where the TARDIS power levels are down, and I added in the little noise from Death to the Daleks where, you know, and he goes, like that, and all them, wow, the stuff with the engines inside. Added all this stuff in. Do people notice it? I don't know, probably not, but I notice it, and I really like it, and I know it's there. And that, for me, is what it's all about.
From Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Third Doctor Adventures, Volume 7. The Unzar Incursion.
All personnel, stand by for satellite response efficiency test.
Drop your weapon.
I'm an old soldier. It's very difficult to teach me new tricks.
Doctor, activate receptor coils.
Activating receptor coils?
You against the machine.
Full activation!
I think you'd find the results enlightening.
Good work, Sergeant.
They reckon you're a space wizard or something.
Do they indeed?
But the Doctor is dangerous.
He's just one man.
Well, let's just say I'm a scientist without a portfolio.
What the devil do you think you're doing?
International pressure points are being neutralized.
Excellent.
By the way... Hey!
Whoa!
Doctor, the door!
Right behind you! Both of you, grab onto the console!
Doctor, this is insane!
I said I'd never go near this drafted contraption.
They're coming through!
Hold on as if your life depends on it! Because it does!
Doctor!
The Doctor and UNIT will be in no position to stand in our way.
The Gulf.
Look at the light of the moons, the way it skims the waves. It makes them look like mouths.
Maybe the Brigadier left the taps running.
You'd need to leave them running for an awfully long time, Sarah. This is an ocean world.
Just think of the water bill.
It's lovely to see you.
Is it?
Of course it is. Such a delight to see new faces.
I may be able to help.
We don't need any help, Doctor.
I hope not.
I'm sorry.
No ships, no radio. You may be self-sufficient, madam, but if something goes wrong, you're very much on your own out here.
It's coming inside!
The sea screams at night.
What are they? Sirens? Mermaids? But they're worse than that. Are those tendrils? Tentacles?
One false move and...
It's going to collapse!
I know it hurts, but I can ease the pain.
I focus all my mental strength. I break away from this dimension.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Recently, we reviewed on the podcast the Feast of Axos, and I can't remember who the sound designer was for that one, but the attention to detail was so good on that. It took me right back. Because Claws of Axos doesn't get a lot of love from fandom in general, but I certainly do love that one. And
it's a great story. I absolutely love the Claws of Axos. And so the music was by Jamie Robertson and the sound design was by Jamie Robertson. But there you go. The guy's great. I love Jamie. He's a genius. I've got a very good close working relation with him because we work together on the Eighth Doctor stuff, which is kind of my main Doctor Who range. But he's great. He's a details guy. And again, he's somebody that he loves doing the work. He'll get a kick out of making a sound and listening to it back and thinking, oh, that's great. It sounds really good. It's that passion, you know, that we all kind of really enjoy making noise.
Yeah. So do you, you mentioned before that you digitize the episode so you can go in and get sound. So you actually lift the sounds from the series, don't create them from scratch?
It depends entirely on what it is and how clean it is and if it's needed. You know, I like to... There are some things that you just simply can't ignore. So there's things like, you know, TARDIS sound effects that are very specific to a time in Doctor Who. It's very difficult. You know, you have to make sure that you get them right. And, you know, I mean, here's an example of something, actually, that kind of marries them both together. So, for example, if you look at the doors in the Third Doctor TARDIS console room on the inside... when they open, you've got that very familiar noise. Now, obviously, what you get is the sound effect on top of the, on, you know, with an image of a door opening. So you know very clearly that the door's opening. But in audio, you might not know that there's a door that's opening. You just hear a weird noise. So part of that is taking these sound effects, and then what I do is add in some noises of maybe the hinges of the door, you know, the door's creaking open, you know, might even add in the door whacking onto the set, which they often do, pinging back. But yeah, it's taking these sounds and modifying them a little bit, making them a little bit clearer for audio, for people to know, so that people don't have to necessarily think about what it is, because they know what it is, rather than if you don't come from a Doctor Who background and you've been given it for the first time, you might just be thinking, oh, what on earth is that? Yeah, so it's a mixture. But I like to surprise fans and reward fans for listening keenly by putting things in that they might hear and think, oh, that was, we're doing a Dalek story and there's a really obscure, you know, Dalek sound effect in there. I think it just, you know, so I always use the original Dalek City door sound effects from the first episode. Again, same technique, adding in some metal sort of lift noise sounds. It sounds like you can hear the corrugated metal sweeping up. And I add that in because I think, you know, if one fan notices that, listens and thinks, God, that's the original effect, it just adds a bit of extra excitement. You think, great, you know, they're as nerdy as we are. You know, they love those details.
Yeah, you didn't work on this one, but Return to Skaro last year just blew me away. That was Howard, wasn't it, Howard Carter?
That would have been, yeah, I believe so. I think I did. Did I do the trailer for that? I might have done some sound effects for the trailer. But yeah, you know, he's fantastic. He's such a nice man as well. Musical genius.
Do you do much music yourself?
Sometimes. You know, I've been doing non-stop music recently. I've for two Gerry Anderson releases, I've just done the music for Five Star Five, which is out this week, and I've also been doing some music for Stingray, but I don't do as much music as some of the others, mainly because, you know, a lot of the musical posts have kind of established for various ranges. But to be honest, I'm actually really happy doing the sound effects. I actually enjoy that. All the others will say they like doing music more, but I really enjoy the sound effects side of things a lot more, so I'm happy not doing as much music. But if I'm wanted for music, I'll always do it. I do enjoy it when it comes up.
One piece of music that you did work on this year that I was actually on a walk when I listened to it for the first time and gave me goosebumps. It was the Space 1999 theme.
Oh, yeah.
So what did you do with that? You revamped that? How did you go about that?
So that was one of the things I like doing is kind of decomposing things. So sitting, listening, working out all the individual layers for that, going through it, and yeah, rebuilding it from the ground up. The reason we redo these themes is largely down to licensing, and so it's a lot easier for us to actually remake them rather than license out the original recordings. But obviously, when you're handling these things, you know, it's become a weird sort of sub thing for me, is that I've ended up remaking a lot of older themes with Space 1999, Adam Adamant, Stingray. With something like that, it's just important to get it right. I mean, part of me is always really apprehensive because you just can't, how can you replace real brass bands and huge orchestras, and especially recorded with all the gusto of somebody like Barry Gray, who's a genius. And you replace that with, you know, computer-based sounds. It's not the same. But you just have to make the best of what you do, and I just try to get it as real as possible. And then the geeky side comes through. So I actually, a lot of them, I've got a friend who has a tape player, like a proper quarter-inch tapes analog studio. So I often run these old themes through that just to give it a little bit of an extra kind of analog feel. Just makes it helps to blend these cold digital sounds, because whilst it may be recorded in, you know, the top, you know top studios in the world, it's still just coming through a computer and played by a guy at home. So putting it through a tape just gives that little bit of warmth to it, which I think helps bond it together. So Space 1999 was, yeah, all of that.
We had Chris Thompson recently watching his talk about his movies that he's made. And we played both the movies and both that, because that theme is just spectacular, and the merge of that with his visuals, just very powerful.
He's great, isn't he? His stuff is so fantastic. He's got an eye for detail when it comes to things. I think this week he was making something and going slightly insane by the amount of buttons that he was having to 3D design into the frame. But yeah, you know, it's about getting things right, isn't it? And just trying to please the people that care about it. Because there's always going to be people where, you know, if you turn on Space 1999, the first thing you hear is the theme tune. So you want it to at least sound like the theme tune, rather than you turn it on and think, oh, this is rubbish, doesn't sound anything like it. I'm not going to bother with that.
Well, it's probably better than the original theme tune. The mix is just amazing.
Oh, I don't know about that, but certainly there's a few little elements in there we've added to just kind of make it a little bit. I tried to contemporize it a little bit just to give it a bit of, I think I added this kind of extra drum beat in there and a few little oomphy and bangs and whooshes and things to get it going. But, you know, largely it's the same piece, just reproduced.
Does Jamie have a say in what goes on with Space 1999, or is that fully licensed, you can do what you like with it, or is it someone else in the estate, or how does that work?
I think largely Jamie has a lot of say with what they're doing. I can't speak for that really, because I don't actually know a lot of the inner workings, but I know that Jamie is incredibly hands-on with the, you know, and Nick, they both really care about these shows as well. And so, I mean, I have to say, you know, when it comes to not just Big Finish, but also Anderson Entertainment, there's such a body of hardworking, like-minded individuals, you know, that I've worked on quite a few different productions. And these people, it's the same sort of thing with Doctor Who, really. They really care about it and they know it inside out. I think they know, again, they know where they can go and where they can't go. And so it doesn't need to become a sort of process of, oh, I don't know if we were able to do that, because the boundaries are very, very obvious to them. And so, but yeah, I mean, so exciting what we're doing with, you know, Space 1999. It's great.
Can you talk us through what the process in terms of what you do? So actors turn up at a studio for a day or two. They deliver all their lines. They all get put digitally down. Does your job start when you get handed the script from the director with his notes and the digital? Then what do you do from there?
So I get all this stuff and I think, blimey, okay, I've got a big job on my hands. Obviously, read the script, first things first, make any notes yourself, start planning it out. So what I tend to do is I have a spreadsheet where I take every scene number and every location and I map it down so that then I can work in what I call blocks. So if you've got four scenes set in the TARDIS, I can use one kind of session for all of that. And so I work out what needs doing, what are the things that might need me to record some extra bits and bobs and other stuff that I've got in the library or I've already recorded myself. Then it's down to cutting the dialogue. So making sure that you use all the correct takes, cut anything that's, you know, not working, flag up any problems if you've got, you know, if the recording's garbled or something, which can happen.
Does the director tell you which takes he wanted to use, or do you have a bit of say there too?
It's so the director lists down on the script to say, you know, this take one, take one. Two. Usually it's default to the last take. So if there's three takes of something, you would go and use the third take unless it specifies otherwise, because that is the kind of the last take where the director's happy and says, that's brilliant, you know, let's move on. But then in the script, they might say, use take two, or for one line, they might say, use, you know, from take one. And even then we can use it, but then it is our discretion at the same time. We can say, I use take two, but it doesn't work, or the recording's different, or there could be miles away from the microphone and it sounds completely different. And so it's about getting that flow in place there. It's a collaborative process. And then, yeah, after that, it's just
give us some
working.
Time. So can we have some time frame? So how long did it take you to break down the script originally? How long to put the dialogue together?
Okay, so breaking down the script and doing that, that's, you know, you can do that in an hour. That's just, you know, depending on how long the script is, read through, just write notes as you go. A dialogue edit, that can really vary on, again, the complexity of what you're working with. If you've just got four actors in a room, you can cut a dialogue edit together in about 1 or 2 days, probably about 2 days. If you've got something like the, you know, the COVID-19 style of working, which is four different sources of audio recorded at different, you know, different places, different, then that's, you know, it could take you a week because you've got to go through and find it and cut it and put it all together. So it's kind of, it really varies project to project for that one. And it's the same with productions, really. You know, sometimes it's smooth sailing and you're just in there and working and it's easy, and other times it can just go on forever.
So after you do the first dialogue cut, does the director listen to that?
Occasionally, it depends on, firstly, what the director wants to do, whether they've got the time, because a lot of them are really busy. There's, you know, normally there's a level of trust there. So that can vary. Other times it's just, you know, crack on. And so immediately you dive into doing the sound and you kind of just left to your own devices. And really then you, if you have things that you think are going to be problematic, then you might send over a clip. So like if I've got a monster voice, I tend to send over like four or five different variations of what can be done and then say, you know, what do you think? Because then it's easier for me to establish the monster rather than do the whole thing. And then they turn around and say, don't like it, you know, do it again. So but a lot, that's probably the only collaborative aspect you get when you're in, you know, in production. Once you finish something, then you send it over and you await their notes. And if they're merciful, you'll get a few. And if they're not merciful, you'll get a lot. Varies.
Treatment of voices, you always do in this, you do it later, not done in studio at all?
Very rare. I think the Daleks get done as in studio, Nick has his ring modulator. Occasionally the same is done for Davros. I think we sometimes record Davros on his own as well, as two separate feeds. I think pretty much everything else is done in post. Yeah, we don't get any effects added on in studio.
What's the rationale behind that for Nick? Why isn't it done post-production?
I think there are various different reasons. I think first and foremost, it helps with the performance.
Yep.
To be able to be a Dalek, be a proper
Everyone
Dalek.
Everyone seems to love it when they hear it.
Well, that's the other thing. If you're an actor coming in, you want to hear, you know, you're doing a Dalek story. You think, great, I'm doing a Dalek story. You want to act against a Dalek. You don't just want, you know, the experience of just a shouty man. But also, I think from Nick's perspective, it's probably just down to the fact that he knows Daleks very, very well. And he knows how to make them sound good. And so it's probably easier for him to just do them, send them over, and then he knows the sound designer doesn't need to get it wrong or do something that sounds weird. It's kind of, it's all, you know, all done for them, basically.
Is there anything that's been announced that you've worked on that's coming out in the next couple of months, or you just don't know what the schedules are?
So out this week is Sherlock Holmes. So that's on its way. That's out. Very proud of that. My first Sherlock Holmes. Love doing that. Completely different to anything I've done before. And then in terms of coming out in the next few months, I mean, I'm working on, just started work on Stranded, the new Stranded, Stranded 3. And also I'm going to be working on more Survivors, which is great because we'd finished that and it's been revived. And so there's more of that. So they're the two things that I'm working on at the moment. And as well as that, Stingray and Five Star Five. So I've been quite busy in that. But yeah, I mean, I tend to just mainly work on the Eighth Doctor stuff for Doctor Who, really. I've been doing that for so long now. So it would be weird not doing it, I think.
So will you be working on the new ranges that have been announced for next year too?
If they want me, yeah, I think so. I mean, I imagine so. I have a great situation with Big Finish in that it's just kind of, you know, they'll just say, you're doing this next. It's not like, even though I'm a freelancer, so technically, you know, it's kind of like, you know, are you able to do this? Can you? A lot of the time it's like, right, you know, we've got another Eighth Doctor coming up, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, cool. So, you know, I tend to just find out as and when I'm doing something and then I'm doing it. And sometimes it's a case of, you know, with Sherlock Holmes where it's like, we got Sherlock Holmes, we're recording it this week, are you able to do it? But, you know, I told them they were in session recording it and they they messaged me and said, you know, are you able to do it? And they're in session. Ken's there going, great, oh, you know, good to have you on board, but they're recording it. So sometimes I've got a lot of time and other times I haven't. It really varies, to be honest.
So do we just get a time frame in terms of from the day you get it to the day you finish? How long
you're trying
are you
to pin him down on this on yes, this time, aren't you?
Yes. I want to understand how long. It's the person I don't understand. I want to know. How long do you get? Weeks? Months?
Again, it varies. You know, we try to get things done ideally and sent off sort of, you know, at least a month or two before the CD pressing. It can just vary. Some jobs are very swift. Sometimes you have to work on things very quickly to get them done. And it's a lot of, you know, long days and late nights. And other times it can be a breeze and you've got, you know, you can work at something in your leisure and just do it in the evenings if you want and do other things in the day. You know, the Unzal incursion, that was a pretty swift one to do, actually, to get that one down. That was, you know, that was really, you know, there wasn't a lot of time and there was a lot to do and there was loads of sequences with planes taking off and, you know, explosions and time craziness. And so to get all that done in a short amount of time was a real challenge. And other things, yeah, it's just incredibly relaxed. So honestly, I wish I could just say, like, we get given this time to do things. But often it's just as and when it comes in and what we're doing. And because as well, so a lot of our work comes down to when we finish other jobs as well. So you can be given three jobs and they're all kind of relying upon the other projects that you're doing, not to be delayed or not to be held up or things, because things do go wrong all the time. Things go wrong. So it's a weird sort of varied process.
Are you happy with that, Philip?
Yeah, well, I wasn't really after an exact number of hours. He won't give me that, but never mind.
I don't know.
Yeah, I believe you. Yeah, I should say, what are you working on right at the moment? But I'm sure you won't tell us that either. Now, in terms of, there's some amazing actors that you're working with, their voices and so on. Did you get to meet anyone ever, or are you just always stuck at home in your sound studio?
I do get to meet people, yes. So they often get, you know, we get opportunities to go up to the recordings and just kind of have a bit of time just to hang out and talk to the team that we work with every day through email and other things. I often have, you know, when Ken's working on something, I'll be up in the studio sometimes and we'll be hanging out and we usually prep each other on the project and what we're doing or what he would like from it. But yeah, I get to meet plenty of people, you know, have the great big Finnish lunches, have some lovely chats, you know, always have a good chat with Paul McGann over lunch. People like that, you know, it's always a joy going up because you always end up meeting somebody you've never met before or hearing great stories from people. And, you know, for me, it's just lovely watching actors doing their thing because it's just so cool, you know, to see them, especially people that you've watched for years, you know, Doctor Who, just to be able to see them being Doctor Who in front of your face is just so, it's mind blowing. It really
now,
is.
You have a huge range of voices that you put on all the time. How come you don't do more with acting yourself?
I don't know. I've just never, you know, I think part of it comes down to, you know, actors study. They study to be an actor. And so for me to go in and have not studied or do anything, I don't know. It just feels like, not disrespectful, but like, you know, give them the work. I'm doing my sound stuff. And I, you know, I've got some things up my sleeve for my own productions of things which I might do some voice stuff in myself and enjoy. That's one of my things that I've kind of set myself to do this year is to produce one solo production. But whether I get the time, I don't know because I'm so busy. But I would love to do a bit of, you know, there's so many different things I'd like to do and try stuff that's not just sound, but it's just a case of finding the time to do it, really.
You could be the Al Pacino of Big Finish.
Can you imagine? Can you? I'd like, you know, it would be great. It would be great fun to do something. Definitely, I'm sure it'll happen one day. I've always said I'd like to play a vicar. That'd be fun. Like over, you know, when you've got soap operas, there's always some bloke who, if you meet him in the pub, and somebody say, "Oh yeah, I was an actor once." What did you do? Well, I played a vicar in Coronation Street once. But I'd like to be that guy. I say, "Yeah, I was a vicar in Doctor Who. That'll do."
Give us your best vicar.
Oh, gosh, my best vicar. I mean, the thing about vicars is they talk in such a way, you see. You know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit amen. You know, they're very measured like that, you see. And so, yeah, I love it.
So what was that spark that that you had with Nick Briggs that got you two guys in such what seems to me to be a really really strong friendship apart from anything else? But you guys have a good chemistry on the podcasts, and how did that all begin?
So, I mean, the first time I met Nick, we dispute this because he can't remember and I can remember. Is I met him when we were at, I used to do a lot of work at the Big Finish conventions, just kind of used to come down, help out really, and just hang out with people because it's just a chance to meet and talk to people that you work with really. And and we started just messing around, and you know, he'll say the odd thing from quote from Doctor Who, then I'd say one back, you know, don't be a fool, man, you know, and things like that. And we ended up kind of just laughing with each other really. And you know, we've got a great friendship which is just built upon laughter. He invited me in to do a bit of podcast work, just a guest star on a podcast with him, just for a laugh really. And we just sort of realized we have loads of things in common. We love old telly, things from the past. You know, we've got a very similar sense of humour. Both don't take ourselves too seriously. And so, you know, this bathroom being made is so, sorry, it's so funny. I feel like the floor above below me is going to crash through. But, you know, we're always laughing, and we're just, you know, we find that, you know, one of our favourite things to do in the evening is just take photos of what we're watching. Because we're always watching some old rubbish. You know, what was I watching yesterday? I was watching Zodiac from 1978 or something.
Yeah, the serial killer thing. That's good.
It's not that one. It's a different Zodiac. It's this weird show that was only ran for one series. And it's about a sort of astrologer and a policeman who solve crimes together, and it's very 70s and very a bit naff. But you know, it's the type of thing we both actually thought it was going to be rubbish, and then we actually really enjoyed it. But you know, we're always watching things. He's always watching a good old war film or just Doctor Who, to be honest. And we often just message and say, yeah, you know, what are you watching? Oh, I got this on. This guy's great in that, or he's terrible. Oh my God, the plot in that's dreadful. So yeah, just a relationship built on the same interest, I think, reading humour.
So what's something that Nick has introduced you to that stands out in your mind as something you never would have heard of if it wasn't for him introducing you to it?
Do you know, there was actually a really obscure thing that he introduced me to, which I really enjoyed, which is called An Englishman's Castle. And it was this, he lent me the DVD. It's this, I think it's the last ever thing that Kenneth Moore did. And it's like this weird thing about this guy who it's in a sort of alternative reality where the Germans won the Second World War and they're occupying the UK. And there's a chap played by Kenneth Moore who's making a soap opera. And he realizes that he's kind of producing like propaganda for the Germans in the sense that he's saying how, you know, we didn't stand a chance in the war and how we should just kind of accept being occupied. And eventually he begins to like question it all and starts then thinking, you know, I must stand up and do something about this. You know, and it's a really obscure thing. And he introduced me to it. And I remember messaging him saying, look, I can't stop watching this. I was on a train I was doing something up in London. I said, look, I've had to stop what I'm doing, go into, I think it was Itsu or somewhere to get some food and just sit and finish this because I won't be able to function unless I knew how it ended. But a lot of shows, you know, I only have to look on my Plex where I digitise my DVD collection to see, you know, The Sandbaggers is something special branch, you know, loads of things. Heaps of programs.
That show sounds eerily like The Man in the High Castle.
It's interesting they both got castle in the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a good series, The Man in High Castle.
I think the novel came out in 61 or something like that. So,
well, maybe there's a link there. You know, it's interesting. The Man in High Castle is great in terms of, I love all the CG work they've done in that to make it kind of, you know, construct these incredible scenes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I still haven't seen series 4 yet. I must get to it.
Gotta get on that. So
has there been anything that you have been able to introduce to Nick that he didn't know about?
Oh, that is a good question. There have been. I've got to think about this now. But there have been things that I've introduced him to and he's enjoyed.
Not the tripod.
I can't remember off the top of my head, though. I'm just looking through all my stuff. Maybe the Pathfinders, I think I showed that to him, although I don't think he liked that, so I don't know what that says. Piece of Cake is one of them, actually. Again, weirdly enough, war-related. Piece of Cake is something I introduced to him that he really enjoyed, which is made in the 80s. Really good series about Spitfire pilots, actually. 1988, six-part television series about the Battle of Britain. Which I recommend, actually, if anybody likes watching, you know, likes history. That's a really cool thing to enjoy, actually. Just looking through now. Often he's heard of things, and he will introduce them to me. It's like Public Eye. He introduced me to Public Eye, and I'm just obsessed with it, you know?
All those shows I've not heard of. I need to take
it's
a look at
the
list.
Part of our podcast is the obscure, you know, the amount that when, you know, the Benji and Nick show. We have loads of people from all over the world writing in, telling us about shows they grew up watching and stuff like that. And it's you know, that's really rewarding to see these shows that we've never heard of and see for the first time and think, you know, we did one the other day, which is Under the Mountain, which was, I think, a South African program or New Zealand program. And it's, you know, really good. I think, blimey, you know, I'm really surprised that this hasn't been, you know, played over here, but you just, yeah, it's the way it goes sometimes.
Well, thanks so much, Benji, for having a chat with us about all things sound design and some of your podcast stuff as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Philip, was there anything that I missed?
Oh, I'm sure there is, but maybe he might come back sometime in the future and we can dissect
always,
something.
Yeah. Always happy to.
At some stage, what I'd love Benji to come and do is actually dissect in detail what he's done in terms of sound effects, the technical side, because I think some of our listeners would really love to hear really specific hard, you know, cases, you know, what he's using in terms of his machines and, you know, the whole rigmarole of what he does.
I'm more than happy, I'm more than happy to dissect my workflow and all the tools I use. I've got many. I can talk about gear all day.
when Big Finish first started, I came over to England for a convention in, Newcastle on Tyne, and a few of the Big Finish crew, and I can't remember who it was, came up to talk about sound design. And so there's a presentation they gave, and they brought up sound machines, and they actually got us to do some voices and things. I know all the witches from one of the productions, I can't think what it's called, with Betty and anyhow, they had all the females cackling, and so I'm actually on a couple of early audios, laughing and clapping and applauding and cheering for some of the early shows. But what they did in terms of showing off their craft, in terms of how it went, was really fascinating. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, it'd be great for you to play around and show us some of your tricks.
Well, still to this day, you know, if I need background voices for things, I'll sometimes call upon mates in and say, do you mind just being, you know, we were doing a Survivors once, and I said, look, they're meant to be held hostage with loads of people in the post office tower, but we haven't got any recorded wild tracks of other people. So I had to call upon some friends and said, look, can you just, you know, mutter in a corner and pretend you're really, pretend you've not drank for a couple of days. And so my friends there go, oh, I've not drank for many days. Like that. And he's in the background of all these scenes, and bless him, he actually, he really went for it. So yeah, but no, more than happy to talk about the intricacies of stuff like that, because it's, you know, if people want to hear it, then that'd be great. If I can inspire somebody else just to, you know, for me, I really want to make it so that other people can experience what I experienced starting off, which is just to enjoy making sounds. You know, you can do it nowadays, even more so from when I was younger. Now the possibilities are limitless. You know, one thing I will say is, this is not giving too much away, but when I started doing sound design years ago, I was using a program called Reaper, which is an audio editing program which you can use for free for, I think, you know, about 6 to 8 months before paying. And when you pay, it's only about, I think it's about $60, right? So it's not pricey at all. Then I moved on to other things. You know, I was working in it. I thought, oh, yes, I'll get the proper tools and do all this sort of stuff. And use a variety of different programs. And do you know what? I've recently come back to Reaper and then work on that humble bit of kit, which is actually incredible. It's I would actually argue that it's more powerful than any of the others in terms of what it can do. But the crux of what I'm saying is, you know, I'm using a bit of kit that you can actually pick up for next to nothing, and you can do the same work with that tool. So, you know, just have fun is really what I'm saying to people, because it can start a job, it can start a career, a creative career. You might discover an aspect of that that you think, this is what I want to do, because it's so cool. It's a cool and different job. It really is. Fill up one of those blokes that goes to schools and says, now you can be a fireman if you want. Now, who wants to, you know, you ever thought about being a fighter pilot? But yeah, you know what I mean.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We usually finish up the show by giving a few recommendations of things that we've been listening to. And it's often my turn, but it's not my turn today. It is Philip's turn. What have you got for us to recommend, Philip?
Yeah, well, I think in honour of our guest that we have today, I'm actually going to recommend the Survivor series from series four onwards.
series three,
the sound design gets really good. we don't talk about Survivor as much on this show. It was... I didn't really know it. I mean, I knew Terry Nation had written it. I hadn't watched the TV show. I came first to the audios. And they were so bleak and so depressing and so awful, but compelling. It's like watching a train crash. You just can't look away because it's so powerful. And you get so attached to these characters, and they do the most awful things to them and then kill them off. But in terms of human drama, in terms of themes of survival and what we are, what makes us human, I don't think that series has been bettered. And I have since gone back and watched the original TV series, and the first season and a half is brilliant, and the rest is okay. But I actually think the Big Finish productions are so much better than even the TV series was. The casting is amazing, and the sound design and the music are spectacular. So if you want some gritty realism, and certainly these COVID times...
we all feel like we've lived it. I think that's why we're doing more, as we thought, oh, we've lived it now. There's more stories to tell because we've experienced it ourselves. With Survivors, it's we always say you can't listen to Survivors, you can only experience Survivors. Yeah. It's been designed in a very different way. It's a way that you feel like you're there, you're living it, and it's important to feel that.
I don't think I've wept more or felt disgusted more than that show. It's interesting because I would like to have thought that human beings were better, but having just gone through the last 18 months, I'm not sure that we are. Because seeing some people and the utter selfishness, and I think Survivors really brings out human beings, and it brings out, like in the last 18 months, it's brought out the actual worst in people and the best. I mean, we've seen some...
The best, yeah.
There's some lovely, generous people, but you really see people divided in over the last 18 months, and I think Survivors shows people divided. You've got the most amazing characters looking out for other people, caring for other people, and then you've got the worst who just... only themselves. And yeah, we're living Survivors, and yeah, it's really worth listening. Have you listened to much Survivors, Dwayne?
Not too much, no. I have got at least the first box set or first couple, but no, not too much at all. No,
it's worth a go.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of those. It's interesting. Big Finish. It was one of those evil things. They released the first episode for free, and so I listened to it, and that. Unfortunately, did mean I had to buy every, so I bought all the box sets then. But it was just really? that one episode which was released for free, and that yeah, and they've done that a few times to me.
You are the customer they're looking for.
I am. I had no intention. I had no intention of buying Survivor. I didn't know it at all. I hadn't watched the TV show. Oh, it's a free episode. I'll listen to it, and by the end, I was just. And since then, all the box sets. But it really gets good after season three.
It's the Walking Dead without the zombies, and instead of the zombies, it's other human beings. I would actually say that series three is one of my favourite things I've ever worked on, and one of the proudest bits of work that I've done. I think I'm really proud of that series, and that, but you know, that particular one. It was so dark working on that. You know, I was in the studio for it, and that was one where we had to cut back a lot because it was pretty. The original script and the original performances, it was just too much. And sometimes the stuff that was written, we could say, do you know what? We don't even need to say that, because it's absolutely, the performance has said all these things without us even needing to. But yeah, it's dark and scary, and very proud of it. Very proud. I was so pleased we're doing more. I can't tell you how I was so envious when I listened to that first episode when it was free. I was really, really jealous that other people got to work on it. I thought, oh, come on, I wanted that one. So to get given that, I was just over the moon.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions. Survivors, Series 3.
London calling. This is London calling. Almost a year since millions of people died and everything ended. I don't know how many survived here in Britain. Maybe thousands, maybe hundreds. So I want to know, what happened to the rest of the world?
The truth is, I've done terrible things to stay alive.
Hello, I'm Maddie Price.
Abby Grant. This is Daniel Connor. Pleased to meet you.
I'll let you know if the feeling's mutual.
The name's Jimmy Garland. You've got some friends of mine that I'd like back.
I know some people think I'm mad to keep looking for Peter. But you know what? I'm not just trying to save him. I'm trying to save me. Because I'm scared that if I believe Peter is dead, I'd want to die too.
Some of the people left behind, they're so filled up with anger, grief, it overwhelms them. They keep it all inside. You should let bad feelings out.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Yes, and the new release, I mean, we should just mention that, for people who may have missed the announcement, that it's not called Survivors, but they're bringing back the characters and the aftermath of Survivors in two box sets. So there's some new stuff coming. Which, are you working on that?
I am. Yes, I am. I've
already done.
I've got the stuff. No, I've got it. It's my next job. That and Stranded are the next two that I'm working on. So I begin that one pretty much from this week, actually, which is really exciting and miserable at the same time.
I think The Survivors also has Louise Jameson's first script for Big Finish. I'm pretty sure it's
her first, yes.
Which is the all-female cast. And it's a stunning show. And she's got characters going off and weeing in the grass and things. And it was interesting because, you know, and I've said this to Louise, in terms of you do things with women that other people couldn't do. But she's got menstruation, she's got weeing on the side of the road, she's got... So thinking, it was just... Yeah. That's her,
though. It's things that people, you know, don't talk about. It's things that, you know, aren't in the media eye and stuff like that. We know we're great because we actually have such a huge amount of talented women working for us at Big Finish. And so to be able to do things like that is just wicked, and to get them involved and to have, you know, an all-female cast on a production like that is incredible. And I love Attagirl. I think Attagirl 1, and that's another one actually I wish I'd have worked on, because I love that whole time. I love the Second World War, things like that. Spitfires are my thing. So would have loved to have worked on that one, but it sounds so fab. So to be able to listen to it is just, yeah, amazing.
Sorry, Duane, I've been raving on. Have you listened to anything that you want to recommend?
You beat me to it, but I want to recommend something that Benji's worked on too. I can't remember if we've recommended it before or just talked about it, because we had Sadie Miller on a little while ago, and we were talking about the Third Doctor box set, even though she doesn't appear in your episode, Benji, the Unzal Incursion. So I would like to recommend that box set, Series 7 of the Third Doctor Adventures, and it's the sound design that gets me on that one. It takes me right back to my childhood, and that's what I want. I want to go back and I want to imagine that I'm standing there in front of the TV with my cassette deck next to the speaker recording it. And it's the feel that you gave me, the whole team, but you working on the sound design too. So thank you for that. That's my recommendation.
I had Luke Pietnik on the other run there, and he's so great and so just committed to work. He's such a pro. He's just got such great judgment and technical know-how. And he's a really nice guy. You know, he's one of the chaps that that he actually listens to other people's work and will message you and say, I really enjoyed what you did there. You know, and that is just such a nice thing to do. And as well as that, you know, you've got Sadie, who is just lovely. And I did some recording with her. And she, you know, when she started, you know, playing, you know, her mother, which is, you know, gosh, must be a really scary task to do. It just blew me away. I got slightly emotional hearing it because it's just, she's just so spot on. And she's just really lovely and she cares and she knows about it. You know, she really cares about what she does and doing it right. And so, yeah, it's an absolute, you know, marriage made in heaven, really.
Yeah, so that box set is, you can actually see the contrast very clearly between Series 7 and Series 11 from the sound design and the music. Luke, did you say his name was? Sound design?
Yes, that's correct.
Has he done much else? I don't recognise his name.
Yes, he has. He's been with us. he's been with us for quite a few years now. He's worked on the Class series. I've got his resume here. He's done a lot of the Blake 7 stuff. He worked on the Silurian Candidate. Blake 7. Yeah, that's it. So he's done a lot of kind of the different stuff, but he's great. Again, you see, another person who started out in fan audio and fan films. That's where he started. I knew him before Big Finish because he worked on those things. And so we very much cut our teeth doing the same thing.
Cool. So now it comes to you, Benji. Is there something you've been listening to? It could be anything. It could be music, could be audio drama, anything that you like that you've been listening to that you would like to recommend to our listeners.
Well, actually, I was going to. I'd already decided from the word go, which is actually Return of the Cybermen, because I mastered that one. And sometimes I get the great job of being able to just master things and not have to work on them, just listen to them. It's like your job is just to listen to it. That's my job. And so I sat down that one. Obviously, love that time in Doctor Who as well. Early Tom Baker, you know, Revenge of the Cybermen. Controversial story, that one. Do people like it? Some love it, some hate it. It's a really weird one. This is Return of the Cybermen, which is a kind of first draft of the script, really. And so it's completely different. There's similarities there, but it is completely different. And I've sort of, over the past few months, because Nick's been working on that one, I've heard bits and bobs and he sent me things and he said, you know, do you think this sounds okay for this and blah, 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 blah. But listening to it, I just think it's a really different thing for Big Finish because it's like hearing a story that you know really well, but you don't know it at all. So it's really strange. So you think it's going one way. You think, oh, yeah, they're going to do, you know, this is the bit where they're going there and this happens. And it's like, no, it's like we're going to have a ceiling coming down on them. Literally a ceiling coming down and trying to crush them, which never happened in the television version. So I'd say that is a really good one. If you like your Doctor Who, you know, why not combine it into a double whammy? This is what I would do if you've not seen the original Revenge of the Cybermen. So I would watch Revenge of the Cybermen and then listen to Return of the Cybermen. And then you've got a weird thing where you can kind of cross-reference them. It's really fascinating. So that's my recommendation.
Awesome. Thank you. What I really love about that is Nick did the music too, didn't he? So
He did everything. That was his post-production, that one, yeah.
Yeah, so he did something really fascinating with the music on that because Kerry... Kerry Blyton?
Yep.
Correct, yep.
I think he only did three stories, didn't he? Silurians, Death of the Daleks, and that one.
Two of the Zygons.
No,
he didn't do that one. No,
not two of the Zygons. No, only those three. Okay. What Nick did was he combined elements of Carey's music and he injected bits that reminded me of Earthshock, and then he injected bits that reminded me of Sword of Orion. So he was like combining all these different Cybermen story elements into that. But staying true to Kerry Blyton's original music, which I found was, it wasn't just taking me back to the music, it was just adding on top of it as well. So it was really, really enjoyable to listen to that one.
It actually made me how much of Sword of Orion music he'd been inspired by Kerry Blyton. So yeah, now I listen to the sort of Orion soundtrack and actually hear a lot of Kerry Blyton when you actually see the two merge together.
Mm. Yeah.
I think with a lot of these, you know, Kerry Blyton was a really weird and unique composer. You know, his stories stand out to me as a music lover because they're completely unlike, really, a lot of the Doctor Who music. And they've all got flavours of what's going on in the stories. You know, Silurians is kind of medieval influence of the primitive instruments. Death of the Daleks is very much unplugged kind of, you know, there's no power on that planet. And so it's all back to basics, brass saxophones, you know. And then with this one, it, again, stripped down because the Nerva Beacon is kind of empty. There's not a lot going on there. It's not the great, you know, bustling, space station that we saw in the Ark in Space. Instead, it's empty and dying. So I think there is a lot of thought to what Kerry does with his composing.
And the Cybermats are scarier in Return to the Cybermen. I'll give it that.
They certainly are, yes.
Very good. Thanks so much, Benji. Really appreciate you coming on.
It's been great having you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute joy. It's lovely just to talk shop with like-minded individuals. And yeah, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This has been the Sirens of Audio, Episode 75, Wired for Sound, with our special guest, Benji Clifford, and your hosts, Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Next time, we'll be sharing an exclusive chat with the man behind the business of Big Finish, and a name you see on every single release, executive producer Jason Haig-Ellery. Theme music by the Jackpot Golden Boys. Email address is sirensofaudio@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube and your favourite podcast app. Find links to all our socials and other info at sirensofaudio.com. And if bathroom renovations happen to be driving you up the wall, slap on those noise-cancelling headphones and listen to some high-quality audio drama. Because audio drama... Rawr!